but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I love good stories. You know that. You love that I love to talk to interesting people, leaders in particular, and our next guest falls in that category. His story is a story about resilience. It is a story about following your passions and your dreams wherever they may take you. Joe Moglia, not only the head football coach at Coastal Carolina, but he's also the former CEO of TD Ameritrade. He left college football, left coaching in the 80s, went to go to the corporate world where he rose to become CEO of TD Ameritrade. Then he went back to football. They always talk in football, hey, we want a CEO to lead our program. Well, Coastal Carolina did it. Joe Moglia, great story. Where does it start, Joe? Thanks for joining us. But where does it start? Where do we start telling your story?
I appreciate that, John. Thank you. My dad was born in Italy. He never finished second grade. He moved here when he was 11. Wound up selling bananas and apples his entire life. I worked for him from the time I was 10 to the time I was 22. And he met my mom after World War II. She was born and raised in Ireland. And she wound up coming over here to marry him. And Ireland was kind of going, it's still part of the potato famine, and was last for like a long, long time. And there was nobody in the family that could afford to come over. Now, did you ever see The Bronx Tale?
Yeah.
With Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's where my father and his family lived when they moved here. So that entire time, that's the Italian section of the Bronx. There's only about 7-8 blocks, you know, it's Italian. Then you go out of that and the world changes. Now, my mom, on her side, my grandfather, who died when I was about 10, 11, he couldn't read or write. He literally signed his name with an X. So I got a father that doesn't finish that grade. I got a grandfather on my mother's side that Kate couldn't read or write. And one of the things I really wanted my children to understand is that literally our entire family is a generation away from poverty and illiteracy. And, you know, think about where we are today, and we should really be filled with gratitude with that. All right, so that's the background. Now, when they got married, they moved to the Dyckman Street section of Manhattan, which was a gang area. And I was the oldest of the five. Seven of us lived in a two-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment. I was part of a gang from the time I was 10. And there were two guys, two of my very close friends that I was with every day in grammar school, that they were killed in high school. One died of a drug overdose, so he was killed by the police robbing a liquor store. Had I not been playing high school football, I would have been with a guy robbing a liquor store. Not maybe. I would have been with a guy robbing a liquor store. So that was a pretty good wake-up call, and I wanted to do better academically. I went to Fordham Prep, all-boys Catholic high school in the Bronx, on the Fordham University campus. And I wanted to do better in my grades. I was a football and baseball player. I wanted to be able to play both in college if I could. Then my girlfriend got pregnant. That changed my entire life. The sports were out. I'm going to become a father. My dad liked the fact that I wanted to stand by Kathy. But his advice to me was, you know, well, don't go to college. That's ridiculous. You know, you need work. Come to the food store. Well, they will have two food stores, maybe three food stores. And I said, Dad, I think I really got to go to college. And he reminded me we didn't have any money. I said, okay. And then when I told him I'm definitely going to college, he said, son, you're making a big mistake. Now, think about that for a moment. You know, I'm not going to be 19 years old. I'm trying to go to college. I got to pay for myself. My whole life changed. My father's coming and making a big mistake for going to college. All right, so I wound up going to Fordham. And my freshman year, I'm supporting my wife and my daughter. I'm paying every dime in my education. I'm driving a yellow cab in Manhattan, a truck for the post office, and working at my father's food store. And that wasn't the most fun a freshman ever had in the history of college freshmen. It was also the first year of my life I didn't have sports. So Fordham Prep, where I'd gone to, offered me a coaching job. So my sophomore, junior, and senior year, I coached high school ball at the prep. And worked for my father in the off season. I majored in economics, wanted to go to Wall Street. And But after my senior year fall, so that was my third year coaching, I really loved the coaching. And I still want to go to Wall Street, but I thought if I could get a high school job upon graduating with 3 years experience, I was going to go for it. By go for it, I mean I would want to be the head coach of Notre Dame one day, head coach of a major school one day. And so I applied to about 100 schools, and the one high school job offer I got was at a place called Larchmont Academy, and that's exactly in Claymont, Delaware. And by the way, John, I had never been really much more than 20 miles or so outside of New York City. I thought Delaware was the deep south. And fast forward a little bit, now I'm the defensive coordinator at Dartmouth. It's 1981, so it's about my 13th year in coaching. Now we now have 4 children. Well, we're in the middle of a staff meeting, and the sheriff from Hanover comes in. Dartmouth is in the Ivy League in Hanover, New Hampshire. And the sheriff from Hanover comes in, he needs to see me, and he apologizes. I think there's a death in the family or an accident. He apologizes, says, I'm sorry, coach, and he hands me divorce papers. Now, that was a tough one, and I couldn't afford to live independently and take care of my wife and children, so I got permission to move into a storage room above the football offices. And I didn't mind that so much, but it had no heat, and the temperature is averaging single digits in the wintertime in New Hampshire. I could see my breath there.
And the story goes, you're working at Dartmouth and the University of Miami, who in the 1980s, all the coaches at Miami were going on to do big things, right? So there was a lot of turnover on that Miami Hurricanes staff in the 80s. They offer you a job coaching their defensive backs. You consider that hard, but ultimately you turn the job down. And that, I think, propels you into Wall Street, does it not?
It was the hardest decision I have ever made in my career. I turned down that job because I didn't believe I could do my job if I didn't feel I could live up to my responsibilities as a father. Well, that told me I needed to get out of coaching. Well, remember, I always had that desire to go to Wall Street. So I recognize I'm still coaching to Dartmouth, but I recognize I better figure this out. Bottom line, I do. And later on in that year, I get an opportunity to join the MBA training program at Merrill Lynch. There were 26 of us, MBAs from Harvard, Stanford, Wharton, et cetera, and one football coach. Everybody says, the football guy's not going to make it here, but I did. And a few years later, those guys were working for me. And I began as a bond salesman, and I did well there. In my fourth year in production, I was the number one salesperson in the world for Merrill. And but eventually, again, my strength is leadership. So as good a sales guy as I was a better leader. And I think the firm started, as Wall Street started to have problems, leadership became more critical. And that's part of where my career started to kind of a little bit take off. And very, very, very proud of my career at Merrill. We have the dot-com boom, and the market blows up. The dot-com era and the dot-online firms and a lot of the technology firms are really, really deep trouble. We have a pretty serious recession from March 2000, March 2003. Ameritrade is going out of business. They do a national search. I had remarried in 1995 and raised 2 stepsons, and they offered me their job. And we take it. And so we moved from New York City to Omaha, Nebraska, where we're Ameritrade headquartered, and we really were going out of business. And I realized probably after several weeks that our real strength wasn't anything to do with finance. It was transaction processing. We're in transaction processing. That's technology. And I don't know shit about technology, but I know how important it is. So that's our strength. Well, in the financial world, you know, that's buying and selling stocks. So we're really a technology firm and a financial wrapper. Understanding that was really critically important. So everything else that wasn't part of our core competency, we eliminated, and we used half of that money to be able to help us break even and start to make some money, and then we poured all of our money into buying and selling a stock. And when we started to get that figured out, Schwab really should have started to roll up the industry and consolidate, but they didn't. So we did. And so at the end of 2008, which was the financial crisis, we had gone from, this includes the financial crisis where we took a significant hit, but we didn't do anything wrong during the financial crisis. We weren't overly leveraged. We weren't investing in the mortgages. I grew up on the fixed income side of the institutional world, so I understood if you do something like that, you leverage too high and it moves against you, it's going to kill you. Now, I'm pushing the envelope all the time. I'm not going to cross it. I'm not going to cheat, but I'm going to push it. But you can never push it so far that your institution, your organization wasn't going out of business. And that's what Wall Street did then. We didn't. So our return for our shareholders then was 500%. We outperformed every financial firm in the globe.
Joe Moglia, our guest, former head coach at Coastal Carolina and the former CEO of TD Ameritrade. Okay, so why do you step down at TD Ameritrade? Why not ride that out for years?
I stepped down as CEO because I thought there might be other things I wanted to do with my life. And one of those was maybe commissioner of the NFL because I was they reached out to me about that in 2004, but I couldn't leave Ameritrade. Then in 2006, Paul Tagliabue, who was the commissioner, steps down. And they even approached me about that. But Ameritrade just bought TD Waterhouse from TD Group in Canada. And part of that, we took on the TD name as that became TD Ameritrade. But these acquisitions, the strategic alliances, only work if the integration works. So that was my commitment. So I'd say 2008. So Goodell, by the way, I'm not suggesting I would have got the job instead of Goodell, but I'm pretty confident I would have been on a real, real short list along with him. So that made me think, suppose it's something else I want to do. And we keep acquiring firms, I got to keep staying here. That's why I stepped out. So when the board asked me if I'd stay on as chairman, I said I'd be honored to do that. At the time, my life could have done anything I wanted to. I get a call from a group of alumni at Yale telling me that at the end of the season, their coach might be stepping down, and would I be interested? I remember looking at the phone, John, saying, like, guys, I'm not coached for 24 years. And they said, we know that, but we looked at the skill sets a head NFL or head college coach supposed to have. We believe you not only have those skill sets, you have competitive advantages that other people don't have. There's one problem. Oh, yeah? What's that? Because this has never happened 135 years of college football. And the typical college president probably doesn't think this way. So, but please think about it. Bottom line, I did. At the time of life, I could have done anything I wanted. So I'm going to go back to football.
And so if I understand that correctly, that you then take this job at the University of Nebraska where you are assigned in this advisory role to Bo Pelini, who's the head coach, like, you're training him how to be a CEO. And I keep thinking about this because we're looking at Oregon State and Trent Bray now. Oregon State needs somebody like you. Bo Pelini had you sitting on his shoulder teaching him how to be a CEO.
I was with the defense full time. So when they were there at 1 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday night, I was with them.
Not long after that, you end up with the UFL as the head coach of the Omaha Nighthawks. That must have been a wild time.
It was the third year of that league. The other my competitors were Jimmy Fossil, former New York Giants, Denny Green, Minnesota Vikings, Marty Schottenheimer, fifth when he was coach at the time, history of the NFL, and Jerry Glanville. I think he was with Houston. And you know, that's where they had been. And me. But the league went out of business. And so we just got through three or four games. And that was a shame.
Then comes the call, the big break after all those years. The president at Coastal Carolina has the wherewithal to go, hey, this former CEO of TD Ameritrade is back in the football game. We could use a CEO. They bring you in. They're making the transition from FCS to FBS. This was a shrewd move.
Bottom line, that was it. Because I knew my competitive advantage, John, was not to go as a coordinator or a linebacker coach. My competitive advantage only would have been as a head coach. So that's the only way I would have taken the job. And I did. And very, very proud of my career at Coastal because of the success we had at the FCS level. We invited to the FBS. I was part of that transition. I stepped down in 2009. My successor, I was executive director of football. So we were the only program in the country. The football did not report to the athletic. It reported to me, and I reported to the president. Mm. So as executive director of football, I still ran football. And when NIL happened, and our athletic director wasn't doing what he needed to do to kind of get involved with that, I didn't want to be doing all that. Otherwise, I'd still be coaching. So we hired a new athletic director a couple of years ago, so I gave up football then. But the whole while I was coaching, I was chairman of Ameritrade. And I finally stepped down in 2019. I negotiated the deal with Charles Schwab, where Schwab acquired us. I was doing that while I was coaching football.
That's fascinating. That's crazy. That's fascinating. You are involved in the financial world and then also the head coach at Coastal Carolina. And then you're negotiating that transition where Schwab was acquiring TD Ameritrade. And, you know, we always talk about program coaches being CEOs. You truly are.
Well, you know, at the time it was kind of interesting because that came hot around that, like about 2010 or so. You know, we want the CEO and the coach is CEO. I was that guy, but nobody wanted to interview me. Nobody wanted to give me a shot because they said, oh, you know, well, come on. You have a coach for a long time. You don't know what you're talking about. And a lot of people didn't even look into my background. So, but that was my competitive advantage. And now we talked about leadership, so I'm going to give you one more point. And that is, we did a couple things at Coast Carolina that nobody in the country does. First thing we did, we had no rules. We had a standard. If you have looked into my background, by the way, this is a website, Moglia.com. Is that Moglia.com? That's it. It's simple. And I'm sure it talks about this. It's BAM. So BAM, be a man. So stand on your own 2 feet. Take responsibility for yourself. Always treat others with dignity and respect and live with the consequences of your actions. John, I wrote that when I was a senior in college, when I was getting ready to take the Archer job. That's in my 1971 Archer playbook. That was the heart and the foundation upon which we built Coastal Carolina's football program. And that's been the same standard I raised my daughters on and the same standard I had of myself and over my entire Wall Street career. The executives and senior people that ultimately I was responsible for, I didn't call BAM, of course. That was the standard. So it's really an acronym for leadership. My daughters were raised on it. A real man, a real woman, a real leader stands on their own 2 feet, accepts responsibility for themselves, treats others with dignity and respect, and lives with the consequences of their actions. That has been my competitive advantage over the last 5 decades in my personal life and my 2 different careers.
The world we're in now, it has to look interesting to you. And I know you're still involved as a donor. And, you know, I think they're naming everything after you, you know, the field named after you, everything, which is great at Coastal Carolina. But I'm fascinated by your vantage point of what you see happening now.
And it all happened about 4 years ago. And I was asked to give a talk back then. In fact, it was supposed to be a leadership talk. It was supposed to be about BAM, to Division I Athletic Director. It was April 4 years ago in Dallas. And the night before I was supposed to give the talk, Gene Smith and two or three of the major athletes, more senior athletic directors came and said, Joe, you know what? We don't want to. Like, NIL was like 4 weeks old. And they had committees, and I was trying to sit in those meetings. I was sitting on those meetings. And they said, we want your honest, unfiltered perspective of the state of college athletics. I said, you really want me to give you that? I said, yes. Okay, now I was thoughtful and respectful in terms of how I did that. And again, it was football, college football is part of my life. These are the athletics. So I said that the NIL is the most significant thing to happen in the history of college sports. And in the history of college sports, and the NCAA abdicated their responsibilities. In my 5 decades across 2 different careers, I've never seen a more horrific example of leadership. My recommendation is you fire them. You break away from the NCAA. You create your own institution with your own laws and have your own executive team, because they not being there when they needed to be is horrific. So, and then, you know, they're talking about committees and they're trying to do this. And they called it the transition committees. But I sat in those meetings and said, well, maybe we can do it. But, you know, that's not going to work for girls tennis. So I said, you got to get the money right first. So the money is with football. So you got to begin with Power 5 football at the time, Power 4 football now. And I said, you got to be able to figure that out. Once you figure that out, you figure out men's basketball. Then you do it, and eventually you figure it out. But you can't do it this way. And so nobody's ever done that. So there's total, absolute, ridiculous chaos. And you have some on the more senior, the better players, not the typical player. But, you know, the really, really big, more the big-time players, they've got real agents. Well, all they do is negotiate deals and contracts, et cetera. The athletic directors don't do that. You know, they talk to a college agent, but not in the previous NIL world. It's very, very different today. That's why a guy comes in and you fire him and he got like a gazillion-dollar contract because he failed. It's a joke. If the NFL ran themselves where college athletics is today, the NFL would go out of business. What you got to do is powerful football's got to be able to break away totally and from the NCAA, and it becomes the PCAA, the Professional Collegiate Athletic Association. They bring in, they model themselves after the NFL. It was a very, very successful business model. They get executives, one executive team that has real authority really runs the place. You have collective bargaining. You have real transparency, which doesn't exist at college today. Salary caps. You have all the different things that would take place in a real business. And you do that. Now, hopefully, you're still saying the kid's got to go to school, he's got to graduate. Hopefully, that still matters. You know what, John? I've not heard one word out of the NCAA about academics in the last 4 years. Nothing. APR, really quick. I don't hear anybody talking about this. It's a joke. So you have a kid can play at five different schools 5 years in a row. And so it used to be, you know, coach, what kind of opportunities I'm going to have, what kind of facilities we have, what kind of this, what kind of that, what kind of major can I get. Now it's like, what kind of NIL opportunities I have. And if somebody offers somebody 50 grand, somebody else 100 grand, he goes to play 100 grand. And so if you did that right, then I think then you could have, you're never going to put the genie back in the bottle. Never. So other players are still going to get paid, but let's stick with football. You got the G5 schools. So the NCAA, maybe that comes in and says, here's your chance. And then if you want to make a lot of money, you got to get recruited by the Power Four schools. They're the professionals. Here, we're not amateurs, obviously, but maybe the NCAA would come up with a number, like what's a fair number for girls tennis? What's a fair number for boys track? What's a fair number for football? So eventually, if you got this right, it'll take a few years, but it's not going to get right the way it is now. You have the Super Bowl, you have the PCAA National Championship, and you have the NCAA National Championship. And you can kind of take it from there. But the whole issue is lack of leadership.
You are on the show for a reason, Joe Moglia, former CEO of TD Ameritrade, former head football coach, Coastal Carolina, is with us. Joe, all right, so how many schools are in that upper division? If I make you the commissioner, is it all of the Power Four, or do you consolidate it a little bit? And then, you know, you've got schools like Oregon State, yeah. Washington State, Boise State that would love to punch above their weight. Coastal Carolina, you know, you have schools that would love to punch above their weight that can't get into that Power Four. Is there a promotion opportunity, relegation? What do you do in the middle there?
The model that a lot of people believe is the European soccer model, right? But you got AAA teams doing really, really, really well. They get invited up. They get invited up to the premier level.
Yeah.
And soccer, I think you could have something like that. But if I were responsible, first thing I would do is I would think about. I'd begin with all the schools in the Power Four, but I would try to see what I can do. The reason why the Big Ten has such an incredible TV contract is because they negotiate for everybody in the Big Ten. So today, the Big Ten, each of the schools in the Big Ten is making probably $100 million for football. SEC is probably 75. ACC and the Big 12 are probably 45, 50. I'm pretty close. If that's not accurate, it's pretty close. And so suppose you had all four of those conferences and you brought them all together. I'm going to negotiate a television contract for all of us. Whatever that television contract is, I guarantee you, it's ultimately not right away. So you hold the Big Ten like constant for probably a couple of years. But the SEC goes up a little bit. And the ACC and the Big 12 go up a little bit more quickly because they got to catch up because you're going to have a salary cap. And then from there, you just got to continue to grow depending on what kind of money you get from revenues with the TV revenues. Let's say that determines the salary cap. Now, if the people that were negotiating on the TV side, the content media side, they said, you know what, you got 65 schools, but really only you got really 40 real schools.
We're all watching this. People are a little disillusioned. It, you know, everybody's looking out for themselves. You hear this over and over, the Big Ten and the SEC, they're always doing what's best for them. Schools are leaving conferences because it's best for them. Nobody's thinking about the greater good. Nobody thinks about the ecosystem and the market. From a guy who's worked in the college world and the business world, can we afford to do that?
Well, I think what's going to happen is I think college sports, professional sports, especially the ones, the real major revenue ones, you know, frankly, the United States has not done a great job yet expanding to Europe and Japan and Asia. And I think this could be much bigger than what it actually is today. And as long as TV is willing to pay the money they're willing to pay, I just gave you the numbers that the Big Ten gets. You know, whether you're the bottom of the league or the top of the league, it's an astronomical number. That doesn't even count revenue sharing, John. It doesn't even count what comes in, you know, from concessions and other revenues and the donors and the collectives. I mean, I predicted at the beginning of the season that 3 years from now, so the end of the 27th season, we're going to have a handful of guys in football making $10 million, making eight figures. So you're going to have a 20-year-old kid making like $12 million. You already have 5, 6, 7, and the money is so big that they don't know what to do with it. That's why they can have a beautiful, beautiful stadium, and it, but they indoor facility is like $125 million, and you're a beautiful indoor, beautiful weight facility, and you blow it up and span it to make it bigger and better. I mean, it's a waste of money a lot of times. They don't know what to do with their money. It's academia. It's not a risk. Now, these people are smart. They kind of always don't run, but they're not business people. The risk-reward piece associated with that, how you make money. The reason why nobody's willing to do it now is because they're making so much money. Well, why would you change it? And the NCAA is so desperately hanging on to keeping Power Four football as part of the NCAA. They're not enforcing it. They're going to let them do whatever they want. So that's why I think at some point it's got to change. And I think the potential for that to change will be the next time one of the major conferences comes up with a new TV, has to negotiate a new television contract. And I think they're going to put their heads together and maybe figure it out. At least I hope they do.
Joe Moglia, you're the best. We'll get you back on again. I'd love to pick your brain on other things. Appreciate you and congrats on such a wide-ranging and amazing career. Keep it going.
John, I very much appreciate that. Thank you. All bye-bye. Right.
There he goes. Joe Moglia, the former CEO of TD Ameritrade. What a story. What an amazing story. The immigrant story. It's a story of perseverance. It's a story of hope. It's a story of resilience. It's a story where a kid that said, well, why do you have to choose? Why can't it be economics and football? Why do you have to choose one path? You know, we talk to people all the time and say, you know, well, you can either be, a great mom or you can be a great career woman. And you can't do both of these things. Joe Moglia, what an amazing story, and such wisdom from in leadership in particular. We'll get him back on at some point as well. You got the Bald-Faced Truth statewide. Leave it here.